Welcome back, Ruby Tuesday. I'm Patrick Ruby of Sports on Earth, and today we're going to talk about a budding revolution. A budding revolution by NFL cheerleaders. Now, when you think about pro football cheerleaders, you probably think about what you see. Pom-poms on the sideline, dance routines, swimsuit calendars. But you probably don't think about what cheerleaders actually do, which is in fact a job. That sideline, it's an office. And as it turns out, that job features crappy pay and lousy work conditions. So crappy and so lousy, in fact, that there are not one, not two, but three lawsuits that have been filed this year by current and former NFL cheerleaders against NFL teams, alleging things like failure to pay a minimum wage, forcing cheerleaders to do unpaid work, imposing illegal fines for things like gaining 5 pounds, and even having to submit for weekly, and I quote, jiggle tests, in which cheerleader coaches scrutinized cheerleaders' bodies while they did jumping jacks. Joining me to break all this down is a writer who has been at the forefront of documenting what's actually taking place behind the spray tans and the extra tall cowboy boots. Amanda Huss. She's a staff writer at Slate and also has written about the subject for ESPN the magazine. Amanda, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start with something you wrote about at Slate, or something you actually wrote at Slate. You said the cheerleaders are rising up. They're putting down their pom-poms. They're demanding a better deal. Why is this the case? Because they're being exploited. Well, from the interviews you've done or the allegations in these lawsuits, can you break down what kind of exploitation we're talking about?
Yeah, so right now there are three lawsuits in play, one against the Oakland Raiders, one against the Cincinnati Bengals, and one against the Buffalo Bills. But across the league, it seems like the conditions for NFL cheerleaders are pretty similar, and they're pretty terrifying, actually. And so the main issue is that cheerleaders tend to be paid a flat fee for cheering at 10 home games. Mm-hmm. And the fee ranges from like $50 to about $175, but that fee is supposed to cover all of the work that they're doing for these companies, which includes, you know, thrice weekly practices, swimsuit calendar shoots, which they're not paid for. They're not paid for the time, and they're not paid for the use of their image in the calendars.
Really?
They also, right.
Wow.
Yeah, they sign off all of their images to the NFL, which is actually, this is one place where you can really directly compare them to players. You know, in a lot of cases, obviously, mm-hmm. they don't have much in common in terms of the jobs they're doing. But players, you know, if the NFL sells a photo of a player on their website, for example, the player gets a cut of that.
That's right, because they have a group licensing agreement.
Yeah.
Right, they have a union. They have a collective bargaining agreement. Cheerleaders, like you're saying, don't have any of that.
They don't have any of that.
So, by the way, cheerleaders, just when they're talking about image rights alone, mm-hmm. they sound a little bit like college athletes, which is a big hobby horse of mine, but please go on.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, there are a lot of parallels, I think, in a lot of different labor fights that are going on right mm-hmm. now. But the other thing is that these cheerleaders, in addition to all of this, you know, dedicated work time that they're using to support these teams, they also, the teams have this sort of scary amount of control over them. They have control over the way that they look. When I spoke to cheerleaders with the Oakland Raiderettes, they're given a celebrity photo at the beginning of the season, and they're told that their hair needs to look exactly like this. They need to dye it in this way, use, you know, extensions if they need to, get bangs maybe, and style it exactly in this way for the entire season.
They don't even get to pick the celebrity. It's like, here you go.
No, they don't get to pick the celebrity, and also, there are some, you know, these are all sort of framed as perks. Like, when mm-hmm. you go to the salon to get this haircut that we are forcing you to have, you'll get half off, which means that you only have to pay $150
as opposed to
$300 for getting
Oh, so it's half off, but you're still paying out of your pocket.
Right, exactly.
Presumably with the, like, $75 you're making per game, it doesn't seem like we'll get into the math in a bit, but it doesn't seem like it adds up.
I know. I mean, one of the sort of more interesting things is how little shame some of these teams seem to have about that situation. In the Raiderette guidebook, it states explicitly, it's very possible that you will come away at the end of the season not making any money, because either you're going to spend it on your hair products and your tights and your uniforms, or we're going to fine you for gaining 5 pounds, and we're not going to put you on the field because of your, they call it a weight issue. So it doesn't seem to be something that they're really ashamed about doing. And for a long time, you know, I first started writing about this in 2011. I wrote about the Redskinettes and sort of the process that they have to go to apply for this job and to audition, and then what they're paid when they finally get the job, if they do. And they're put through this, like, corporate ringer where even before they apply, they have to pay a fee to apply. And then they go to this clinic where they trot out all of these people, makeup artists, even, like, LASIK eye surgery people,
really?
Artificial tanning people. And they say, you know, we're not saying that you have to go to this artificial tanning place to get this job, but if you do, it can only help. So they're, like,
wow,
trying to sell this stuff on these women before they are even a part of the organization, which I thought was ludicrous.
Wow, and you have to pay a fee just to apply for the job.
Right.
And what
it's
a
sort
scam.
Of like, it's a bit of a pageant sort of situation.
Mm-hmm.
Seems really similar to something that you might do, you know, as a college student in a Miss USA type of pageant with the hope that maybe you'll be the one girl who gets a scholarship. Except that this is a job where these women are sort of required to come and do a very specific thing for teams that make a huge amount of money every year, and they're not seeing anything back from it. But when I first started writing about it in 2011,
mm-hmm,
I couldn't really find anyone who cared. Certainly the cheerleaders who had a job with the team, you know, I couldn't find anyone who would say publicly, yeah, like, it's a really shitty deal, you know? It's
mm-hmm
difficult, I think, to get an employee to say that. But even outside of the cheerleaders, you know, retired Redskinettes looked back fondly on their experiences.
So I want to get into that with you in a little bit. But before we get there and sort of the psychology at play and the reasons why people would do it, I want to go back to something you just mentioned. I want to kind of go through the math a little bit,
mm-hmm,
because I don't know if people would understand this. So when you say they're getting paid, was it $75 to maybe $175? That's kind of the range per game.
Mm-hmm.
And that's 10 home games a season. So we're talking like maybe $2,000 or so in a season, maybe a little more, probably a little less.
Right.
Just on a home game, if you're a cheerleader, how long is your day? Like, how many hours are we talking about of work? And I don't just mean being on the sideline. I mean pregame, postgame, getting there, everything that would, you know, count as part of your work day.
Yeah. Well, let's use the Raider ads as an example because I tend to know a little bit more about exactly
mm-hmm
the work that they do. So they make $125 a game. You know, it's for 2 preseason games and 8 home games. And for that game, I mean, it's hard to count up the amount of work and money that they're putting into it because they're doing, let's say, 3 practices before the game
uh-huh
that they're not paid for. I was told that they're required to be at the stadium for about 9 hours on a game day because
wow
they're sort of the public face
mm-hmm
of this
of course
franchise. They're there, you know, when people arrive at the stadium. And by the way, they have to look on point when they get there. There are, like, things in this guidebook that's like, do not come to the stadium wearing curlers or, like, looking anything less than your Raider at best because people will see you walking into the stadium and they want you to look like a cheerleader and not just like, you know, the mom or the student or the stewardess that
or
you are
a real person. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, this
a human.
Is funny. This is like a that part is a little bit like I've written about mascots in the past and like the cardinal rule for mascots, and this is a little flip, but it's in a way there's a parallel. It's like never ever ever be seen in public with your mascot helmet off in the costume, you know.
Right. And it makes sense, you know, but at the point where you're having that much control over a person,
right,
please pay the minimum wage at least.
Right. Right. You know, by the way, so you're talking about like if it's a 9-hour day, now all of a sudden that, you know, $75 for a game, you're right, it doesn't add up to the minimum wage a lot of cases, does it? If you're just doing, and again, we're not even talking about those practices during the week or anything else you're doing during the week. We're just talking about one game day where, you know, quote unquote, you're at the office.
Yeah. And, you know, another thing that can happen when you show up that morning is, this was sort of one of the most bizarre things to me. The Raiderettes are required to stay within a 5-pound range of the point at which they're hired. And when I talked to some of the women who do this, they said that they were weighed right before their swimsuit calendar shoot, which was very early in the morning when many of these women had been, like, training and working out and dieting and, like, the day before, like, not eating because they're going to have their photos taken in, like, bikinis.
Right.
This is the weight that their, like, baseline weight was taken at that time.
Wow.
And if they go more than 5 pounds over it, or even, you know, if the scale seems fine, but they're looking a little soft. They use terms like soft, like in the thighs or in the stomach.
Oh, God.
It's not just that they'll be benched for the game and not paid, which is true, but also they have to come in that morning, and right before they're supposed to go on the field, they'll be told, sorry, because of your weight issues, you're benched for this game. They have to stay there for a time when they're not being paid. All of the other cheerleaders have to reconfigure their lines to figure out how they're going to do this performance, and it's really sort of this just horrible scenario.
It's a shaming thing. It sounds like a total shaming thing.
Yeah, the team tries to make it seem like it's their fault,
right,
that they are not getting paid this money that they're owed. And obviously, you know, when you're stuck in, you know, behind the scenes of the game all day, you're not going to be able to make money doing anything else. So that's probably like one of the most extreme tactics.
That's really weird. You know, and by the way, I just want to add something to what you said about that baseline weight in terms of swimsuit shoots, things like that. I don't know if people really realize what goes into, and this is true for male models, female models, anyone you see that's shirtless, in a bikini, whatever, in any kind of magazine, fitness magazine, swimsuit magazine, fashion catalog, whatever it is, you know, taking away whatever computer airbrushing and body trimming and, you know, fooling around with lights and things like that that goes on, all the post-production stuff, those people who are generally professional models, right, cheerleaders we're talking about, these people, people have like day jobs and things like that, these people who are actually professional models, you know, for those shoots, they do all sorts of extreme things in terms of their exercise and diet, things that are very unhealthy that you could never maintain. You know, it's kind of like when boxers prepare for weigh-ins for their fight, and they do all these unhealthy things to lose all this water weight, and then the second they're done with their weigh-in, they go back to being healthy. They gain like a bunch of it back that night. The fact that that would be your baseline weight for anything is actually inviting people to have serious health problems. I don't even mean just things like anorexia. I just mean like serious health problems in general for being underweight.
It's true. And, you know, it's also a very active profession.
Mm-hmm.
So these women, you know, not only do they have to look to keep to this baseline weight, then they have to go out and dance for 9 hours.
I mean, they don't do that with the football players, right? They're out there getting hit and running around things. And I mean, sure, football players have to pass conditioning tests, but no one's like, oh, you know, you gained 2 pounds this week. You can't play running back today.
Right. I mean, I think we can agree that the entire sport of football, like, puts demands on people's bodies that are unhealthy and probably unethical.
I write all about the brain trauma stuff, so yes, I agree with that.
But the difference is that these women don't have a union. And it's sad, really, a little bit, that they're fighting for minimum wage, you know? It's not like they're fighting for huge salaries like some of these football players have. They're fighting for, like, $8 an hour.
And the thing is, I mean, look, these cheerleaders, like you mentioned before, they're you know, a lot of ways they're also the faces of these organizations. They are, I would say, they are some of the best known or the most seen members of, I would say, of team marketing department. That's, to me, that's essentially what cheerleaders are. They're part of an NFL team's marketing department, whether it's official or not. And I bet nobody else that actually works in the team marketing department is subject to anything like this. And I'm sure all of them are paid much better than the cheerleaders are.
I mean, one thing that some people don't know is that beyond dancing at the games, cheerleaders are sort of farmed out to corporate and charity appearances. And so with the charity appearances specifically, they are there to make the team look good, because now the Raiders have a presence at this you know, foundation for raising money for child patients of leukemia or whatever, and it really seems to show that, like, this team cares about them, but really what they're doing is taking people who are not paid. They're not putting any money into this, like, charity. They're just farming out these cheerleaders to appear there to make it seem like the team has a presence. And cheerleaders are often paid pretty handsomely for corporate appearances.
Mm-hmm.
But what I found was many of these teams require cheerleaders to, before they can access any of that money, they have to do 10 or 15 charity appearances first before they'll be sort of chosen for these corporate appearances that can pay, you know, let's say $400 for like 4 hours of work.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of these women don't even have access to what is sort of sold to them as a perk before they sign on to the team.
So the team says you've got to be at a charity appearance, and you know, we're supporting this charity by having you be there, and that's going to take 3 hours of your time, 2 hours of your time, 5 hours of your time. Oh, but by the way, we're not paying you anything to be
right.
there. That's
and
how
you
charitable
have to drive
we are.
There also,
yeah,
and we're not going to pay for your gas.
That's how charitable we are. We're not even going to pay you for being
yeah.
there.
Yeah, I mean, it's so ludicrous that you would think that just because it makes the teams look so bad, that they would just pay them, you know, just pay them a living mm-hmm. wage. And actually, the Seahawks do. They are one team, and I'm not sure, you know, it's possible another team does, but they advertise on their website for women who are interested in applying that they pay minimum wage for all hours worked for practices and everything, which, again, minimum wage is not exorbitant, but
right.
it's at least legal.
Right. They're doing the bare minimum. We're
right.
not going under the bar. We're at least meeting that bar.
Yeah.
The bar is very low, but we're meeting it. That's, good job, Seahawks.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, this one woman, Lacey T., who uh-huh. is the first cheerleader to really start this wave of lawsuits. She's with the Raiderettes.
Mm-hmm. You wrote about her in ESPN, the magazine, by the way. I recommend people go read that article. It's very good.
Yeah, and sort of one of my questions, you know, after having this experience writing about the Redskins in 2011, where none of the cheerleaders seemed to care about this, was why all of a sudden did this cheerleader decide that she wasn't going to accept this, you know, what she alleges is illegal agreement, and she was going to stand up for herself and for all of these other cheerleaders. And I think one answer is that she had come from the NBA,
uh-huh.
where she was dancing, I think she did it for 2 seasons, and she was paid above minimum wage. I think it was about $10 an hour. Obviously, you know, the NBA has many more games than uh-huh. the NFL does. So she was bringing in, like, a decent living
mm-hmm.
with them, and I think she was really shocked when she went to the NFL, which she had sort of perceived as this height of professional cheerleading, like
mm-hmm.
the most just the highest place that she could go with this job.
I mean, the NFL,
and that they were paying
the,
her like hardly anything.
Sure. I mean, the NFL is the sort of richest, most popular, best known sports league in this country.
Right.
I don't think it's a crazy assumption to think, oh, cheerleading wise, it must be the same thing.
Yeah.
Probably get paid a little more. There's probably better perks. It's probably a more professional environment. Whatever you would like think of the NBA cheerleading experience, you might think it goes up a level, the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
And she found out it didn't.
It does not.
Before we get done with the math and kind of move on to some of the cultural questions and some of the other questions I have for you, you also mentioned that cheerleaders have to pay a lot of sort of out-of-pocket expenses for things that are completely work expenses, work-related
mm-hmm.
expenses. Can you just break down really quickly what kind of things are we talking about there?
So as you mentioned, you know, it is actually hard work. I think a lot of people don't realize this when they see, like, these beautiful women who are on the sidelines, that it actually takes a lot of work for them to look that way. And it takes a lot of money, too. So any sort of gym training expenses
mm-hmm.
that they might need are not covered. These salon visits aren't covered, but they are mandatory. They have to pay for their own false eyelashes, which they wear at all public appearances and at the games, which can, it seems small, but it really adds up over like
mm-hmm.
9 months of appearances. Same with tights. Their uniforms, I'm just talking about the Raiderettes here. I'm not exactly sure how this happens
mm-hmm.
with other teams, but for the Raiderettes, their uniforms are paid for, they don't get to keep them. But if something happens to them, like one cheerleader, for example, was at a calendar signing, which of course she was not paid for, and she was signing calendars with a Sharpie, and someone else's Sharpie got on her white, they have these like pirate crop top sort of things, and she wasn't able to get out the Sharpie, and so she had to pay, I think it was over $100 for a replacement.
That just seems so petty. Amanda, it's so petty.
It does. I know. It's like really beating like really, them down just, as far as possible. And I believe the Buffalo Jills actually do have to pay for their uniforms no matter what.
Wow.
But it's like, you know, gas to get places. There are certain things like social gatherings with cheerleaders that were basically mandatory. So they had to go to a bar and, you know, play bocce with these other cheerleaders and buy them gifts and stuff like that, which, you know, is something that, that you might like to do, have like a little gift exchange with your coworkers, but not, you know, if you just have, you're not even making enough money to like buy a drink. So really just everything except for the uniforms they're paying out of their own pockets.
If you're a cheerleader with these out-of-pocket expenses, you can at least write those off, right? Like with your taxes, I think, I hope.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming if you don't make any money, you're not going to really be paying
that. Not to itemize those.
That much. So that's a perk, you know?
I guess that's a perk. You make so little, liability. You're not getting hit on taxes. What a perk.
Right.
Try campaigning on that if you're a politician. See how far
it
goes.
I know.
The other thing I wanted to ask about when it comes to the finances of this is the petty fines. It seems like there are a lot of petty fines. You already mentioned the having to pay for the replacement pirate crop top because of the Sharpie incident. But from reading your work, there's all sorts of ways to have your money taken back from you when you're a cheerleader. Your pitiful amount of money to start with. What
right.
kind of things do you have to like sort of watch out for and be on guard about when you're doing this job?
So for the Raiderettes, it's being late or having an absence to a practice, which really sort of goes against this idea that this is in any way voluntary.
Right.
It's actually something you're required to do to go to all of the practices. So if you're late, you might have to take $10 and put it in your squad coach's hand. If you forget the correct yoga mat for practice, you might be fined. If you bring the wrong type of pom-poms for what the routine you're doing that day, you might be fined. If you gain 5 pounds and it's game day, you will be benched, which means you won't get your $125. And, you know, there's sort of a lot of like armchair, you know, commentators on this issue who say things like, well, you know, it's their job to bring their pom-poms and so they should be fined if they don't do it. When really, I think people have a hard time seeing this as a job where if I go into work and I forget like my computer at home or if I forget my notepad at home, like my boss isn't going to be like, give me $10 for not giving that. Like if I keep like messing up, like maybe I'll be fired. But even if I'm fired, they'll still have to pay me for like the work that I did.
Right. I'm not subject to fines at my office. I agree with you. You're right. I might get reprimanded. I might get warned. I could eventually get fired and terminated. But you're right. Nobody gets fined at their office, formally fined. I mean, maybe
right.
you have some sort of jokey office, you know, jar that you fine everyone. Everyone pays quote unquote fines. Then you use it for happy hour on Friday. We're not talking about that here. We're talking about give me your money. Goodbye.
Mm-hmm. It's a very sort of like paternalistic and infantilizing type of scenario
where it's absolutely.
Like, we give you this allowance, and if you don't behave, then you have to give me $10 back.
It does. It sounds like they're treating like little kids. That's infantilizing is the perfect word. You mentioned, by the way, coaches. Are the coaches making decent salaries? Are they actually everyone here is an employee of the team officially? How does the sort of power structure work and the hierarchy work within a cheerleading squad, once you get past the cheerleaders themselves?
Yeah, so it depends on the squad. For the Raiderettes, there are coaches who are, you know, employees of the Raiders.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much they make. It's not something that the Raiders are advertising.
Uh-huh.
It could be that they're getting kind of screwed over, too.
Maybe that's why they have all these fines. That's how they're eating.
Yeah. But they are employees for the Raiderettes. This woman who was a Raiderette for 10 years, then sort of graduated to become the coach, and she's also this sort of sideline reporter for the Raiders website. So she has this formal role with the organization. But for some teams, it's a little bit trickier, and this is something that complicates this whole labor fight. First of all, there are many teams, as we know, who do not have cheerleaders at all. And there are some teams that where the management of the cheerleaders are farmed out to other companies. And that's true with the Buffalo Jills. So they're run by this like cheerleading management company that the Buffalo Bills contracts out. We're not sure exactly how much money is like changing hands between these two different places.
So essentially, this is like the Blackwater of cheerleaders now. We're getting into private military contractors, but cheerleaders.
Right.
And we know that there's no potential for abuses or shenanigans with those kinds of organizations.
Right. Surely not. And, you know, it's been true, like, throughout NFL cheerleading history that if there's any sort of problem with the cheerleading squad, many teams have just disbanded the squad entirely. So in the past, when some cheerleaders, you know, in the 80s have, like, posed for Playboy, I think this happened, not with the Dallas team, but in Denver, their squad was disbanded for a few years as everyone got over this, like, them sort of capitalizing on this job to, like, make actual money with Playboy. They disbanded the squad.
How dare you make money being a sex symbol? Leave that to us.
Yeah, because your body is for us to use. So the Jills right now are on a hiatus until this whole situation gets figured out. It's possible that there will not be a cheerleading squad there next year. And this is something the teams hold over their heads all the time, which is, A, there are hundreds of women who would like to take your spot. You saw them at auditions. We can throw you off and bring one of them on whenever we want to. And also, you know, if you all start to cause a ruckus, we will just disband the cheerleaders and they won't exist anymore. Which is one argument that people use for cheerleaders not, you know, demanding more pay, which is that they are expendable. And it's true that they are. But in that case, you know, it's like, why keep them around and pay them so terribly if you don't even value what they do?
Well, clearly they do. Clearly they do have value. Clearly there's reasons for it. Like I said, I mean, I think the most obvious reason is they're incredible marketing tools. And if you get that marketing tool on the super cheap, unfortunately, you know, that's how businesses tend to think. If I don't have to pay for this, why would I? Never mind that these are real people we're talking about. And that's not just unique to cheerleading. And by the way, everything you just said essentially applies to college sports, at least big-time college sports as well. You know, oh, well, if we ever had to pay the players, or I'll be more specific, if we ever were not allowed to collude in order to not have to potentially pay players, which is really what's going on in college sports, oh, we're going to have to get rid of college sports. We won't be able to afford it. We'll have to cut all the teams. And it's kind of ludicrous. I think it sounds like, to me, it sounds like a lot of parallels, and it sounds like equally sort of ludicrous argument.
Yeah, like they are literally taking their ball and going home.
Right.
They're like, we're going to take it and just go home because you ruined it.
Pretty sure a $10 billion plus year industry could afford to just kick a few more dollars the cheerleaders' way and keep them around and everyone sort of be happier. But you mentioned history a second ago. You wrote the following at Slate. I want to quote you. Quote, cheating cheerleaders out of a living wage is an American tradition almost as old as football itself. The dual exploitation of cheerleaders, you'll perform our jiggle test, and you'll do it for pocket change, is nothing new, unquote. If this is nothing new, what is the history here? You know, how do we get to the point where players and coaches, but also scouts, beer vendors, parking attendants, I mean everyone involved in the business of football, like we just said, it's a $10 billion industry, is compensated with some degree of fairness and protected to some degree as a employee that these cheerleaders don't seem to be? Why is there this separate thing for cheerleaders historically?
I guess the easy answer is this is an extremely male-dominated industry, and so, you know, the men who are very central to this industry have found a way to empower themselves through it. But the history is, when the NFL sort of first professionalized, teams started bringing in cheerleading squads from high schools and colleges, and these are these more sort of traditional cheer squads that's like rah-rah, you know, sort of gymnast-based and very, like, cheer-based. Mm-hmm. In many cases, they were men as well as women performing. And it wasn't until, I think it was in the late 70s, that the Dallas Cowboys decided...
I knew that they would somehow be to blame for this, but go on.
That they could, you know, get a little bit more out of their cheerleaders. So they moved from this sort of high school, collegiate-based trend toward a more kind of professional look. Their cheerleaders were based off of like Broadway dancers. They called their cheerleaders atmosphere producers, which is really the beginning of them sort of becoming this marketing tool.
That's fabulously euphemistic, by the way.
Yeah, atmosphere producers. And of course, you know, then their costumes started changing. Notably, they got much smaller.
of course they did. I'm sure the hair got bigger and the costumes got smaller.
Yeah, it's true. It's what happened. A lot of other teams said, this seems like a good model for us, and we're going to follow suit. And there was really a sort of, like, cheerleading kind of arms race where other teams, like, beefed up their cheerleading squads, turned them into these, like, glamorous lines. And yet, when this sport was sort of professionalized in this way, it didn't come with accompanying raises for the women who were doing it. And it's sort of interesting if you look at the history of cheerleading and the history of, like, women's sports in general. Mm-hmm. Around the same time that the Dallas Cowboys decided to professionalize their cheer squad was when Title IX was passed. Mm-hmm. And I feel like before then, you know, cheerleading was this way for women to, like, be involved in school spirit and school athletics because they certainly weren't, like, playing sports themselves. Right. And then after Title IX, we sort of got all of this funding in high schools and colleges for girls to play sports themselves. And, you know, cheerleading is still sort of attempting in high schools and colleges to be seen as a sport as well.
Yeah, there are some, like, really at the high school and college level, there are those kind of, like, tumbling routines, flipping routines. There's a lot of athleticism involved at that level. It's kind of a, you know, I think it's in this position of sort of being considered quasi-sport, but if you spend time with the male men and women cheerleaders at those levels, like, they're doing a lot of athletic stuff. They actually have really high concussion rates, and they tear up their knees and all sorts of terrible stuff. So it's definitely different than the NFL pro cheerleader experience in some ways.
Yeah, and the pro cheerleader now, I think, is really stuck in this very old-school dichotomy, where they're seen as people who support men. And, you know, at a certain time, that was something that women were supposed to do, like, for fun.
Well, that's funny. That gets
and not
into
for money.
Yeah, that gets into something else you wrote. I want to quote you again, because I thought this was even more interesting. Culturally, you write, "The job description of the modern cheerleader is a hyper-glamorized version of what American women were traditionally expected to do for free before they entered the workforce en masse. Namely, look pretty and support their men. NFL teams stepped easily into the creepy patriarch role." Again, fabulous sentence. But what kind of cultural attitudes or assumptions, or maybe just, I don't know, for lack of a better term, factors, do you think still contribute to or shape what you've been documenting in terms of cheerleader pay, cheerleader work conditions?
Well, again, you know, I think before women started working alongside men, it was many women's job, a housewife's job, to support her patriarchal figure, to look really nice, and to sort of, like, provide, like, the sexiness in the home. It's mm-hmm. like, it was the woman's job to sort of maintain the sex life. And the NFL has really found a way to create this whole industry of women who do those things. It's, you know, it is a job that where, like, sexiness is a factor. Mm-hmm. These are beautiful women, all of them. And I think a lot of people still don't see that there's a great deal of work that goes into doing that.
Right.
You know, whether or not some of us agree whether like that's a good thing that that job exists. It is a job.
And by the way, on the work front, beyond the like, I'm sure you saw this firsthand. Anyone who doesn't think there's work to that, go hang out with a cheerleader for a week in terms of like what they do at practice, what they do at games, what they do in the gym. See if you can keep up. Like you're probably gonna, your legs are gonna fall off, your arms are gonna fall off, and your lungs are gonna burn out. Like it's definitely work.
Right. I mean, it's definitely true that a lot of these people who are saying, you know, that it's not a job are not people who could ever do that job.
Right.
Most of us could not. But I think that the NFL, you know, weirdly, like, makes this patriarchal role, like, really explicit in a lot of ways. For example, the cheerleaders who cheer for the Raiderettes are treated as sort of, like, too sexy almost to be a central part of the organization. So they're told not to hang out in the office because wives might complain. They're told not to fraternize with players. They're not allowed to go to players' parties, even if they are invited. And one cheerleader told me that she was invited to the office Christmas party, the Raiders Christmas party one year, but unlike everyone else invited, she was not allowed to bring a date. So they're sort of kept...
Wait, so don't hang around because you're too sexy and players or people, other people in the company's wives might get threatened in some way. Don't ever date the players. But when you come to the Christmas party, make sure you're alone. But that doesn't make any to the Christmas party.
Like, yeah, exactly.
That makes no sense on so many levels.
Right. And also, you know, anyone who's been to a company Christmas party can recognize how horrific this is. They're not allowed to drink at the Christmas party.
Oh, God.
Or anywhere else.
Why would you torture anybody like that?
I know. It's really horrible. So they're sort of kept in this position where they're supposed to seem sort of always available but also untouchable. It's really odd.
That is bizarre. Again, this is like you could probably write 10 different thesis projects on just that sentence.
Yeah, but I also feel like, you know, I'm not sure if this was intentional, but what they're really doing is keeping these women away from men, right? So they're like, don't consider the men you work with coworkers. Don't talk to them. And also, don't bring, like, your husbands and your boyfriends, like, into this organization. And it's interesting because, as we know, like, many men in the NFL are paid much better. They mm-hmm. have union organization. And I wonder if sort of keeping these women separate was a tactic to have them sort of not get any ideas. I know it sounds like conspiratorial and crazy, but
you come to the right podcast for conspiratorial, so don't worry about that. Keep going.
And it's interesting because Lacey T, who was the first to mm-hmm. spark one of these lawsuits, she was inspired by her husband. She took home this contract, and, you know, she's 28. She's a little bit, I hate to say it as a fellow 28-year-old, she's like a little bit on the older side.
It's okay. I'm 37, so you're okay. You're okay here. To me, you're just a kid still. Don't worry.
And she's married and she has a kid, and so she has this sort of whole life outside of professional cheerleading. And I think that really helped her when she showed this contract to her husband, who balked at it. He was like, these are crazy terms.
He's not a lawyer by any chance, is he?
To understand, you know, she had this sounding board who could say, that's insane, and we need to sue them. Where a lot of these women, I think, are, you know, they are kept young. Mm-hmm. It's a young woman's job. Every year they have to re-audition, so there's not a lot of institutional knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I think it's difficult for people to fight that system when there's no sort of history there and there are no veterans who can be there long enough to understand that they're getting fucked over.
You're probably cycled out, what, every couple of years, right? Like the longest tenured cheerleaders, what, probably 4 or 5 seasons maybe?
I think there are some who've like stuck around for like 10 seasons.
Wow.
But it's
difficult in so many
ways to do that, not only because you're really valued for your looks, but also because like people need to like have jobs, obviously.
Of course.
This isn't, you know, going to pay them any money. And so maybe if you marry young, you know, you can do that. But it's difficult to stick around when you really need to start like making money to support yourself.
Also the 5-pound thing. I think just on a practical matter, at 10 years of that, I mean, look, I like working out. Like, a lot of people like working out. But just to have to do that for 10 years, at some point I'd be like, F this. I'm going to
I
have
know.
the second piece of pie. I'm not going on the scale. Do you know what I mean? Like, I just feel like at some point, even if it wasn't a money thing for you, just having to put up with all this other pettiness, unless at some level you liked or needed or wanted that, which I guess is sort of some of the psychology maybe at play with some of this. And oh, by the way, I know I keep bringing up this parallel, but everything you just described about having sort of a young, transient workforce that's kind of atomized and, you know, just when you might get old enough to not be naive and realize what's happening, you're kind of booted out for the next set of people.
Right.
You just described college sports yet again.
Yeah, you just graduate.
So, yeah, sorry to keep coming back to that. I want to get into that psychology because you've talked to cheerleaders. And, you know, at some level, obviously, they know the score or the deal they're getting into. Before these lawsuits and even now, they are volunteering to do this. It's cliched, but no one's putting a gun to their head.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to ask, like, sort of the basic question, which is, why do they do it? You're getting these sublivable wages. You have to put up these ridiculous working conditions. And I should note right here, by the way, in terms of ridiculous, since we haven't gotten to it yet, one of the lawsuits, which was brought by the former Bills cheerleaders, they say that their cheer squad handbook included instructions for how the cheerleaders should clean their vaginas, which I think is just so, speaking of creepy patriarchs,
I mean,
I don't even know what to say about that.
Someone finally told them. I don't know where else they would learn that information.
Just,
you know, like, it's a perk.
Thank God, better late than never, I suppose.
Yeah, like, wow.
If all this is true, so, and you know it, you know you're going to get crapped on. You know, what's the payoff? What's the reward? Why do they do it?
It's a great question. I think part of it is that, you know, going along with these sort of outdated expectations that we had for women, that they look nice and they be sexy and they support men, those, you know, still bring rewards for women, obviously. If you become an NFL cheerleader, you're really sort of, it's a bit of a prize, you know? You're sort of selected as one of the most beautiful women in your city, and you go out every weekend and perform as this sort of object of attention.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a bit glamorous in that way.
Sure.
In a similar way as a pageant might be. Like, I, you know, personally couldn't understand the idea of, like, putting on a swimsuit and, like, walking around a stage for the idea of maybe making some money, but probably not. But this is something that we've told women that like, it's not, that money is not their sort of sole reward, that their sole reward is a husband. And it's interesting if you look at, like, lists of the most famous ex-cheerleaders. Many of them are showing up on these lists. Like, some of them become, you know, Playboy models, or they'll become news anchors, some of them. But many of them become wives of famous people, whether they're players or they're politicians. And I think, you know, it just sounds so outdated and insane now, but there are still pockets of our country where, like, that can still sort of seem like a viable option.
Right.
Is there also
an element of people, I mean, I would think at some level too, I mean, outside of what you're talking about is sort of like social prestige, which again, it might be kind of an outdated form of it, and maybe it's a dying out form of it, but I think you're right. There's still some of that there, and it, you point out very correctly, it gets into all sorts of sort of strange and changing ideas of gender, sexuality, what people's roles should or shouldn't be within our society. Is there also an element of people literally liking to dance or perform, or, I mean, it's sort of a healthier psychological element here too? I mean, I even think of athletes themselves, you know, some athletes, they're also out there for that same thing. They like the ego trip of being a star athlete and people watching them and cheering for them and putting them up on pedestals. Some people though, they actually just like performing. They like to just be out there doing their thing, and they like the actual playing. I mean, I would think some cheerleaders actually like the dancing. They like being part of this beyond the sort of reasons you describe.
Yes. So many have told me that they just love dancing, and they're very good at it, you know. And so many of them have gone through high school and college. They've gotten scholarships to college to be cheerleaders for those teams, and they want to continue to pursue this in the professional sort of aspect. Many women also say that they make really strong friendships on squads, which is certainly true. And it's, you know, it is similar to professional sports where a lot of people say, you know, if they agree to do it, then, you know, maybe we should just let them do it for free. When really, you know, there are a lot of men who would, like, give their right nut to, like, play in a professional league, like, one day of their lives. So it doesn't mean that we can't pay them. I think that the main thing is that, you know, a lot of people sort of see it as a hobby. Like, this is a fun hobby that these women do to, like, express their love of dance and their skills. But the disconnect between that and just the huge amount of money that these teams are making and making off of them, I think has sort of started to give people pause in accepting that explanation for their low wages.
I think you're right about that, and that's something I want to ask you about in a second. But before we get there, there's something else you wrote, and it opened my eye to, like, sort of another aspect of the culture and the psychology at play here. This is what you said. Teams like the Raiders, quote, extend the patriarch metaphor by encouraging cheerleaders to see the team as a family, not an employer, refer their squad mates as sisters, not co-workers, and implying that they'll break the sisterhood bond if they step out of line, unquote. To me, that sounds a little bit less like cheerleading and more like a cult. Is there something culty about this?
I think there is.
Just psychologically?
I think there is. Yeah, but it's also, you know, cheerleaders are sort of put in this weird intermediary space between employees and fans. They're they're sort of like put out there as super fans. They're like leading the cheers.
Right.
And I think in some way, you know, it's their job to support their team no matter what. And that's why they've been hired. And so if they show a crack in that, you know, they lose their jobs. And also just sort of their identity. Mm-hmm. And they're also told that, you know, if they speak out, that they're really embarrassing, like, all of these women who they've grown really close with, who don't see a problem with it, and there's this, like, hierarchy created among the cheerleaders where the ones who are speaking out about the labor practices they're sort of pushed down to this place where other cheerleaders can say they don't really love the team. They're not cheering out of love of the team. They just want money. And then the other cheerleaders can say, you know, we are, like, this, like, pure distilled version of a cheerleader who, like, really does it because she actually loves what she does.
Almost like amateur athletes. Again,
right?
Again, you sound like someone breaking down the NCAA. I'm sorry to keep bringing this up, but it's amazing to me, the parallels. And it's the same, you know, it is a nice, you know, if you're the employer in this situation, I have to say, and I say this as someone who's in D.C., so I spend, you've been in D.C., nothing but political consultants here. Nothing but people framing issues left and right. If you're the employer, you can frame this as a matter of, like, oh, what you really, this is all about is love of the team and organization. Makes it a little easier for me to control you. Makes it a little easier for me to pay you whatever I want or not pay you whatever I want.
Right. And it also just really puts this pressure on the individual. If it's one individual who might step out and she doesn't represent the other Raiderettes, which is, like, what many people are saying. Right. You know, if you gain 5 pounds, like, that was your choice, and now I'm afraid, I'm so sorry, that I have to fine you, and it's really for your own good so that all of these people can't see you looking fat.
I
like,
have
these are,
to
like,
find
the
you.
Kinds of things that they're told.
Right. It's like, no, actually, what if you didn't find me? You don't really have to. How
right.
about not
yeah.
finding me?
I mean, it's just for their own good.
It's, you know what, again, to me, it does sound culty. Something else you wrote that was very interesting, I really want you to explain. You said that feminism itself is actually a reason it's taken a long time for cheerleaders to speak up, because, as you note, all these suits are filed this year, but this has been going on for decades. It blew my mind that you would kind of call out feminism, because I would just intuitively think that feminism would have been part of why people would speak out, would have helped push that along. But you actually made a really good case as to how feminism may have gotten in the way here. Can you explain how that works?
Sure. Well, when cheerleading professionalized, and we were sort of introduced to these like very busty, sexual Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders, there was a backlash among feminists who said that this was obviously, and it's true, it's objectifying to women. We have men out here in the middle, you know, doing like the man sport, and then we have women who are not wearing any clothes on the sidelines supporting them, and that's anti-feminist. And
gyrating on the sideline. We should probably add, not just supporting, but supporting in a gyration way.
Right.
I'm just saying, in terms of the viral,
if
I'm feeling feminist and I'm looking at this and I'm kind of analyzing it from that perspective, that would also piss me off a little bit, probably.
Yeah, and you know, it's true. You know, when you look at all of the things that these cheerleaders are forced to do, it's not just the money that people are upset about. You know, not just feminists, but like everyone else who's like, why are these men telling these women how to like clean their vaginas and change their tampons? Like, it's totally sexist. Like, the sexism is like built into the job. It's like very difficult to get away from that. But this is sort of happening at the same time these cheerleaders were introduced, that feminists were protesting like the Miss America pageant, and they were like throwing their bras into trash cans in Atlantic City. And this is something like, this is all sort of like new stuff to be like, hey, you know what, like maybe all these pageants are like pretty bad for women. So this was sort of the feminist line for a long time. And it makes sense. But at the same time, there's this other issue, which is that beyond being sort of exploited for their bodies, cheerleaders are exploited, like their wallets are being exploited also.
Right.
And they're not being paid. And I think that's something, I don't know if feminism has like evolved or it's splintered, or we're like able to hold two ideas in our mind at one time, that yes, this is like a reflection of sexism in our society, that this job exists in the way that it does, but at the same time, as long as it exists, we should pay them fairly.
So, like, I may find this distasteful or objectionable in a cultural sense, and I've got a lot of reasons for that, but if you're going to do it, at least have it be fair economically. Is that sort of where we've come to? That's probably a better place. By the way, did one of the former Raiders cheerleaders actually tell you she thought these lawsuits were a feminist conspiracy because they were going to end cheerleading for good?
Yes.
Did I get that right?
She did. That was one of my favorite things. So she had been a cheerleader in the 80s, and now is, she told me, very close to the Raiders organization. So she understands how the men think about this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And for her, you know, she had been cheering at this time when I think, you know, feminists just can't really get it up to care about professional cheerleaders being, like, too sexy anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, in the early 80s, I think it was much more of a new phenomenon and people were actually talking about it. And she cheered at this time. So when she was cheering, you know, she was dealing with feminists who were saying, like, your job isn't a real job and it sucks and it shouldn't exist. And so for her, she's still stuck in this mindset that, like, the feminists are still trying to come and dismantle it from the inside and make all of these teams get rid of their cheerleaders.
So it's all fifth columnists, essentially.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people...
Because I would say that she sounds like she has a little bit of Stockholm Syndrome. But maybe, again, that's a...
Yeah.
For me,
yeah,
for a different...
It's true. It's true. But it's also... I can see where she's coming from, you know, all of a sudden, feminists are on the side of these cheerleaders from the labor perspective. When for many years, feminists and a lot of other people didn't give cheerleaders any sort of respect. Obviously, not just feminists. Cheerleaders are sort of distasteful to fundamentalist Christians as well, because they're performing sexuality in public. And I think a lot of people who even like appreciate the sexiness of cheerleaders have not sort of appreciated them as human beings who, you know, deserve to be paid. So it's not just feminists who have sort of discounted cheerleaders, but it's certainly ironic because you would think, and I think it's true now, that feminists would be the ones who would come out to support these women, because they're obviously being discriminated against in pay because of their gender.
Speaking of support for this and even just awareness that there's an issue here, that there's a problem here, you note that even as much as I think a year ago or maybe 2 years ago, you were on CNN, right, to talk about this. You originally wrote about this in 2011. Last year you're on CNN And the CNN reporter ends the segment by telling you, you're like the only person that cares about this. You, Amanda Hess, are the only person that seems to care about this.
Yeah.
But now, you report there's a change.org petition. You've got 100,000 people, more than that, asking the NFL, hey, at least give cheerleaders a raise. Why is it that people care now? How much is public awareness and sentiment changing on this issue?
Well, I should say that Greg Easterbrook is actually one person who has been following the cheerleader pay issue for many years, for far before I was interested in it, and he also happens to be a big fan of, like, you know, their figures and
right.
stuff also, which I couldn't say that I am necessarily, but so he has been really sort of supporting the cheerleaders in every way possible for a long time. But beyond him, I really couldn't find anyone else who really cared about it. But now I think, you know, the basic thing is that a cheerleader herself has said something about it.
Right.
For a long time, you know, I wasn't sure if I was being paternalistic and saying, you know, you really should ask for more money, and it's crazy that you do this and don't get paid enough money, and you should say something about it. It's not really sort of our place, I think, to say that if we don't know that some of these workers actually agree
right.
with us.
Mm-hmm.
And so after this one woman decided to come out and say something, I think that totally, entirely changed the game. And very quickly we saw these other two lawsuits. Maybe we'll see some more. I'm not sure.
Within these
teams, you know, there are some cheerleaders who are publicly joining the suits, and there are others who are privately saying, you know, I really want to make the team next year, so I don't want to say anything about it, but I do support you.
Sure. You talked to one of the lawyers for the former Buffalo Bills cheerleaders, a guy named Frank Dolce? Is that the name right?
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, D-O-L-C-E.
Yeah.
Frank. And he told you that the lawsuits also, in his opinion, they're a reflection of all things the Occupy movement. He had a really interesting quote. He said, pro-cheerleading is, I'm going to quote him, symbolic of the abuse of workers everywhere by the powerful, unquote, and a reflection of, quote, increasing public realization of the tremendous unfairness of America's present economic situation, unquote. Now, obviously, that is sort of the big cultural trend and economic trend in our times. You know, obviously the whole 99%, 1%, Occupy, you know, what's the top book in America right now? The new book, Capital, right, which
right.
is essentially about a lot of that.
Right.
You know, I'm in the camp of being like, yeah, the system's definitely rigged, and it's getting to the point where, like, almost all of us can't ignore it now. We've talked already in this podcast about the parallels with the economic control that you see in college sports from the NCAA to the athletes. I think you could also say there's parallels between the NFL cheerleader situation you're describing and what's going on with Walmart employees in some ways, even though they do get paid a minimum wage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
do you see those bigger parallels? Do you think that lawyer was onto something here?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, you know, I don't think anyone really says, like, Occupy anymore. I'm really glad that we sort of, like, moved past that terminology, but I think it's definitely true that we've been able to hear from fans and consumers and workers in a way that we haven't before. And so I think, you know, there's always been, like, frustration that fans have had with their teams. But now, you know, there's just so much to report on in, like, the ways that the NFL messes shit up. And they charge too much for their tickets, and some of them have offensive team names, and a lot of the players who are playing for them are dying early because of this game that they're playing, and people are more aware of that than ever, and I think the cheerleading sort of trend is just sort of a part of that. But it's true that a lot of the excuses that you're hearing for people who don't want to pay cheerleaders more are similar ones that you would hear in any other industry. So this idea that if they had to pay cheerleaders more, they would just disband the team is something that you hear, you know, when we're trying to raise the federal minimum wage, for example. There are all of these conservatives who are saying, you know, if you raise the minimum wage, it will shut down businesses and people will just fire people instead of paying them more, which is certainly something that actually happens, but it's not sort of specific to cheerleading as an industry. And I think you also, with a lot of labor fights, you see a lot of employees, like these cheerleaders, siding with the employer because they feel, you know, that that's their best bet. So, for example, Lacey T, she may end up changing the system. She might succeed in getting cheerleaders paid more money. But in the end, you know, she might make up to, like, let's say $10,000 in lost wages, which is not very much money, and she can never be a cheerleader again.
Yeah, she's not going to really benefit from this
right.
suit. It's for one, by the way, for every angry internet commenter out there, this isn't a money grab for her. There's not going to be a money grab. And she's probably, like you said, she's probably not going to really benefit on the back end. It
right.
seems a lot more about the principal and doing something for others who are going to come after her. But speaking of the angry internet commenter, I want to do a little role-playing for a second, and I want to get to the big question at the heart of this. One of the questions that really interests me. So I want you to be Amanda Huss, Slate and ESPN writer.
I can do that.
And I'm going to be angry libertarian internet guy, okay?
Okay.
Okay, here goes, right? Hey, Amanda, these cheerleaders are volunteering. They are free to come. They're free to go. If they leave, there's going to be 100 women to take their place. How can this be exploitation? Okay, thank you, first of all. It was a wonderful performance by me. But coming out
that
of character,
great.
Yeah, really, Oscar, everybody. I think this is exploitation, and I think you can have both. Like, you know, you can like and want to do a job but still be exploited by your employer. But how do you answer this question? Because I'm sure you've seen this and heard this and been asked this and faced this 100 times. How is this exploitation?
Yeah. Well, we've really just agreed in this country that if you perform work for another person, that they are required to pay you a certain amount of money. And it really doesn't matter if you sign a waiver to it or not. So for the Raiderettes, for example, they signed an extensive contract that said not only would they work for this amount of money and that they would pay these fines, they would be benched if they did certain things, but also that they wouldn't tell anyone about how much they were making. And if they they had any issues down the line, that they would put all of their issues into arbitration instead of suing them. However, in the state of California, where they're working, you're not allowed to administer an illegal contract. You can't just sort of sign this away. So maybe, you know, if you want to, like, create your floating libertarian wonderland that is
right.
like, outside of the laws of the United States and hire cheerleaders, then that can be a separate conversation. But for now, in America, like, you have to pay people who work for you.
So simply, this is exploitation because a lot of what's going on is actually against the written law. Makes a lot
yeah,
of sense.
Right, it's illegal.
No, you did a really good job breaking that down. Getting to the lawsuits, where are they right now in terms of progression through the courts? And it, just from what you know, you don't have to necessarily become Jeffrey Toobin here and be a legal expert, but what do you kind of outcomes do you think we'll see? Are they going to get thrown out, settled, go all the way to trial? Whether the one with the Raiders in California or the ones with the Bills and the third team?
The Bengals.
And the Bengals. Do you have any sense for what's going to happen with those particular suits?
I wish I could say. I know what's going on with them now. So the Raiderettes filed a class action suit that incorporates all current Raiderettes and former Raiderettes back to, I think it's only about 2010 that they could do.
Okay.
And right now, as I said, they signed a contract that said that they would put all of their disputes into arbitration. So the Raiders are attempting to force this suit into arbitration, which means that it will be this sort of, again, it will be this secretive decision that's ultimately made by the NFL commissioner, who is, of course, paid partly by the Raiders themselves.
Right. He works for the NFL teams.
Yeah.
He's paid very handsomely, by the way. $42 million a year. And the NFL League Office is a nonprofit. So...
Yeah.
He's got a slightly better deal than the cheerleaders do. But anyway, go on.
Right. So right now, the arbitration issue is the central issue in their case. They're not fighting over the whole pay issue right now. They're trying to keep the case in the courts. And what they're going to attempt to argue is that this arbitration clause, the Supreme Court has decided that corporations have, like, huge leeway to force their workers into arbitration.
Wait, this the Roberts Court?
Yeah.
They ruled in favor of corporations on something.
basically...
No way!
Right.
Yeah. Go on.
And it's, so most of the time, like, the NFL could do something like this and say, you can't sue us, we have to deal with this in arbitration.
Mm-hmm.
However, they can't do it if the terms of the arbitration are inherently unfair. So what the Raiderettes are going to try to argue is that by making the NFL commissioner the arbiter of this, that that's a fundamentally unfair part of the contract. And we'll see what happens with that. You know, either they will be victorious on that point or not. And if they are, it will be interesting because it will really change, like, all employee relationships within the NFL. What they will no longer be able to force all of these things into arbitration with the commissioner, which would be, you know, a huge change for the league. The other teams are dealing with slightly different sort of issues. The Raiderettes are suing based on California law. The Bengals cheerleader is suing based on federal law, and her case is still sort of in limbo right now. And the Jills mostly are going to have to argue that they are serious employees and not independent contractors. So the Raiders call the Raiderettes employees. They recognize them as employees. But for the Jills, the Bills conceive of them as independent contractors.
Right, because
and a lot
that
of employment
sort of,
laws don't apply to them.
As we talked about, there's that private contractor that they sort of go through.
Right.
The
so they're going to try to argue that the team has so much control over them and that they spend so much time working for them. You know, they have to show up in a certain place and wear a certain thing and do a certain dance.
Right.
That they don't have sort of control over their careers as a typical contractor might, and that they are in fact employees.
Right.
But I'm not sure exactly how that's going to happen, so we'll see.
Really interesting. So you've got sort of three different ways that this can play out. Do you think that these suits alone, just by being filed, by the publicity that they're starting to get, largely thanks to you, do you think we'll see any changes either from individual teams or the league as a whole when it comes to the pay and workplace issues we've been talking about? Will this sort of compel the NFL to do better?
I hope so. I mean, you've seen one sort of reaction among the Jills, which is to just shut down the squad, you know, take the ball and go home. So that's something that might happen. And depending on whether you really like seeing cheerleaders, you may care about that or you may not. But I don't know. I mean, right now there's a lot of attention around this issue because of these suits. And because of the suits, like, journalists get all of this sort of juicy information
mm-hmm.
about how the squads are run. But after the suits are settled, you know, if they win, obviously it will change a lot. If they don't win or if they settle, I don't know if it will really change that much, and we might just kind of forget about it, you know, until, like, something rises up again. I actually just found out, I was not aware of this, that in the 90s, the Buffalo Jills successfully unionized. So they started a NFL Cheerleaders Union. Yeah, I knew nothing about this, and it only lasted for about a year. They were not successful in getting other NFL squads to join with them. And at that time, the Jills were, like, managed. Now there's this, you know, this Blackwater company that's managing them. And
mm-hmm.
before, it was, like, a Mexican restaurant. There was a guy who owned a Mexican restaurant who served as their manager and the go-between between the Bills and the Jills. And he just decided, he was like, you know what, after they unionized, and they were sort of accepted to the National Labor Board, I think, decided that they could unionize. And then the guy who owned the Mexican restaurant was like, you know what? This used to be fun. This used to be a fun thing that I did, and now it's not fun anymore, and so I'm not going to manage you anymore. And so they lost their sponsor, and when they went to sort of find a new one, they did find a new sponsor, but as a condition of getting that sponsorship, they had to de-unionize. And now, actually, the woman who runs this company that manages the Jills was a member of that union back in the 90s.
Wow.
And now she's the boss, you know? So
it's funny how that works, isn't it?
Right, yeah. So I hope that things change, but maybe we'll just be, this will happen again in 10 years, and then we'll talk about it again then.
Is there any chance that the NFL cheerleaders across the country would form a union the way the players have?
I don't know. I mean,
are they
just
too atomized and too spread apart geographically? And like you said, they're too transient, people coming in, coming out.
Yeah, and, you know, there some squads are more profitable than others. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders are a huge brand. The Buffalo Jills, like, not as much, mm-hmm. you know? And I think it's very easy for the teams to decide that there's not enough incentive for them to keep it around. Like, the problem with labor organization is that you do need some sort of leverage over your mm-hmm. employer. Mm-hmm. And so if you're a quarterback, that's pretty easy to get. But if you're a cheerleader, it's a lot more difficult. So
has anyone you've talked to been able to give you an estimate of kind of the actual value that cheerleaders generate?
No.
Like maybe a marketing type or something? That's a good question. Maybe that's something for you to look into. That'd be interesting.
Or you, yeah.
Well, me, I know. God, I actually do reporting sometimes, not just podcasts. It's true.
I know. It's interesting, though. We should look into it because there are, among these teams that don't have any cheerleaders, there are some, like, rogue cheerleading organizations that are set up to, like, make calendars and to do charity appearances and to dance, like, at tailgate parties.
I wrote about one of those organizations, the Detroit Lions. They were actually trying to become the official cheerleaders.
Maybe they could tell you. Obviously, they don't benefit from, like, the brand, but maybe they could sort of give you some information about exactly how mm-hmm. much they can bring in. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's mostly like a volunteer operation as well.
Right. That's my understanding too.
But there was some Forbes figure that said that cheerleading teams can make up to like $1 million, which is obviously not very mm-hmm. much money, but certainly enough to like cover the very small cost of paying these women.
I mean, it's you know, another thing I've written about before, like I said, is mascots, and it's very similar in terms of, I mean, sure, a team can go along with this business just fine without a mascot, but it is a really effective marketing tool, and sometimes it's hard to quantify with a mascot, with a cheerleading squad, you know, exactly how many dollars they're generating, but they're generating a lot of exposure and favorable exposure for your team and your brand, and even if you're an NFL team that already presumably has a strong brand, that does have value.
Right.
That does have value even sort of beyond what you can directly quantify. I mean, a lot of marketing, right, brings back value that's hard to directly quantify, but teams do a lot of marketing anyway. And I really feel like cheerleaders fall under that, and I feel like if they were able to sort of, if they're making their case to the public, you know, why, or even to their own teams, you know, why do we bring value? Why are we important? I mean, it's, you know, we're your public face. We're a marketing arm. Like, you take care of us, and we're going out and spreading goodwill for you. It's sort of a win. It could be a win-win.
Yeah, and yeah, it's true. You know, it's sort of like when you go to a baseball game and there's an organ player, you're not like paying specifically for that, but if it went away, like people would be really upset. So it's difficult to sort of...
Yeah, there's also, there's performance value too. There's actually like bringing pleasure to fans at the game value too. I was thinking about sort of all the stuff you talked about that they do outside the stadium. The mm-hmm. charity appearances, the public appearances, the calendars, those kinds of things. I mean, those are all in a small way, probably each of them, but together in a large way, they're marketing your team. They're putting the name out there. They're putting the logo out there. They're putting a face out there.
I mean, and
in terms of selling stuff, I mean, look, we talked about the pro cheerleader is all about sexiness, right? Well, like sex sells. It's not a big, novel concept. Right, you know, lots of companies, corporations, everything from cars to beer to—I mean, you name it—they're using sex to sell their products. And in some way, cheerleaders are the NFL teams using sex to sell their products. And again, culturally, you can kind of take issue with that. Maybe it's distasteful or not something that's necessarily good, but it's done. And as long as it's done, you know, at least do it in a fair economic way.
Right. You know, it's certainly not an easy thing to do, I think, on a physical and an emotional level sometimes. You sort of read in this Jill suit of these women who were, like, farmed out to these companies to sit on a dunk tank in a bikini and to be dunked in front of dudes money.
Get paid for that. At least,
like,
I mean,
that should be a high-paying job.
It should be.
Absolutely
should be.
Or to sit on guys' laps when they're, like, driving golf carts around, and they're like auctioned off as prizes for these like charity golf competitions, which is just crazy. It's crazy stuff.
Creepy patriarch. That was your term. I love that term. It really does describe this.
Yeah, and I guess you can sort of begin to quantify that when you see how much these teams charge companies to hire cheerleaders. I think, you know, many of them that I've seen are like $200 an hour per cheerleader.
Oh, wow. So, see, there you go. So we actually can start putting some numbers on this if we dig. That's interesting.
Yeah.
That might be, you know, that might be the next step. Or maybe, you know, maybe one of the lawyers in these lawsuits will go around and do that and put that together as part of one of their filings. I could see that happening, too.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see.
I would do that if I was a lawyer. I'd be like, look, here's what the best I can do to quantify. You know, not only should we get minimum wage, but look at how much value they're bringing. It might help bolster your case.
Right. Yeah.
Well, look, man,
unfortunately, it's like the law is so, like, the protections of the law are so necessary, but, like, so small.
Right.
They're so small. But it could be, you know, it's possible that it could be something that they could bring to the league in terms of collective bargaining to say that this is how much these cheerleaders are worth to you when you're selling them to someone else. You should pay us, like, at least just pay us half that.
Yeah, I really think, I mean, teams and or the league, I think if they were more forward-thinking about this, they would see the value and goodwill that comes out of this. They would, you know, pay better, make the workplace environment a little less weird and creepy. And I just, like I said, I actually think you could do a win-win here, potentially. And I know that's like horrible corporate speak, but it doesn't seem like it would even be that hard. It would just require being just a little less greedy. Not even a lot, just a little. Mm-hmm. But
yeah,
then again,
true.
We are talking about the NFL, so that's always an
issue.
Yeah, but
if anything, then like I will like stop writing about how creepy and exploitative they are. If they do it.
Right. Well, yeah, I think you'd stick with creepy.
And then they don't have to have that sort of press.
Right. I think maybe the creepy part would still remain, but the exploitative part would be gone.
Right,
that's a win.
Right.
This has been great. I actually taken way more of your time than I think I was supposed to.
No, that's okay.
Oh, good. Well, before we sign off, how can people find you online, and where can they find you on Twitter?
So they should probably just find me on Twitter. It's at Amanda Hess. And then they can find me at slate.com, writing every day.
And that is H-E-S-S, Amanda Hess.
Right.
Terrific. Amanda, thank you so much. It's a great subject, one that a lot of people in sports still don't know much about. You've done excellent work. I encourage everybody, go out and read those pieces. I think it'll open your eyes. I think it'll open your mind. I think it will, the parallels we've talked about with other subjects, I think you'll see them. In the meantime, I'm Patrick Ruby from Sports on Earth, saying goodbye, Ruby Tuesday.